I want to talk about the battle for our souls. You know, we've been talking about growing the church God's way. And one of the things that we have to constantly remember is that we are in the middle of a battle. There is a war going on, and even though we can't hear the bombs or the gunfire or see the explosions, it's because it's not a physical battle, it's a spiritual battle between God and Satan that's been going on since the beginning of this world. It's been going on since the Garden of Eden. And yet that battle, still raging, is of utmost importance to us. Far more importance, in fact, than any physical war that's ever been fought. Because it determines not only whether we live or die here on this earth, it determines instead what happens to us in eternity. And so we need to be prepared for it, and we need to do our part in this battle. Pardon me. As we lay the groundwork for this, I just want us for a minute to think about what I guess I would call the gist of the Bible. Obviously the Bible is a very large book. But I think about what Stephen did in Acts chapter 7, where he kind of laid out the history of the Jewish nation for the Jewish people of his day, and it's not like they didn't know those things, but he kind of laid that out in a fairly succinct, putting the high points together. And I want us to think about that as we go through this. I want us to think about, first of all, an overview of the scheme of redemption. What is this all about? And I know, to some degree, the Bible starts with, in the beginning God created the world. But we know that things happened before that. We just don't know exactly what those things were. We know some of what happened because of what does happen. We know that the Godhead, communing together, determined to create the earth and the heavens and mankind. And we see, even in Genesis 1, that creation of mankind, that God said, "Let us make man," as the Godhead there was discussing amongst themselves, himself, however you want to try to word that to try to get that three in one into a package you can understand. And they discussed these things. But we also know, because Jesus is referred to as the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. Some translations even say before the foundation of the world. That determination was already made. So when we think about the scheme of redemption, one of the things that we have to think about is the fact that God's character, and we talk a lot about His omniscience, that He's all-knowing, or His omnipotence, that He's all-powerful, things like that. But what we sometimes forget to talk about are what I consider the four pillars of His character that make Him, I should say five pillars of His character, that make Him unique, that make Him who He is, that make Him God. And those are His justice, His holiness, His truth, His love, and His mercy. And all five of those are so necessary for Him to be who He is to us. And what we see happening in the beginning of time with Adam and Eve when they fall, we see first of all that God in His love wanted to create someone to love, to pour that love that He had out upon, to love them and wanted them to love Him in return. You know, love always wants to be loved back, doesn't it? Unreciprocated love is one of the worst things in all of the world, is to love and it not be returned. And so God wanted to love, but He also wanted that love to be returned. He wanted His creation to love Him. But because of His love, He created. And He created a world that was holy and good and true and perfect. And there was no sin and there were no problems and everything was wonderful. But Satan entered that perfect world and he caused Adam and Eve to sin through his temptations and brought sin into the world. that sin that Satan brought through Adam and Eve into this world offended God's holiness. Because now the people, Adam and Eve, who he had walked and talked with in the garden, he could not have the same relationship with them because they had sin in their life. And so because his holiness was offended, his justice cried out that they deserved death. That's what he had said. In the day you eat of the fruit, you'll surely die. They deserved that death. And his justice screamed out for it. The mistake that we sometimes make when we talk about Jesus redeeming us, when we talk about this scheme of redemption, sometimes we think that Jesus redeemed us from the devil. But that's not true at all. Jesus redeemed us from suffering the wrath of God because of our violation of His holiness and His justice demanding that we pay the price. And so that's what happened. The mercy and love of God came together to conquer the justice of God, in a sense, but to find a way to fulfill that justice and to restore the holiness so that God could be again pleased with mankind, with His creation. And then, of course, it's all recorded in the record of His truth, the Bible. The Holy Spirit inspired men to write those things down so that we would have a record of what He did to save us from our own sinfulness, our own self-destructiveness. And so as we think about the way that scheme, that plan worked, and we use the word scheme, we kind of think like this is some trickster trying to do a trick, but a scheme just really means a plan. This is God's plan to redeem mankind after Adam and Eve fell. And that's the story of the Bible. The story of the Bible is about God creating a perfect world that then fell to sin. And then that happened right there in Genesis chapter 3. And the rest of the Bible is about restoring that fallen world back to God. And of course, Satan fights God at every step, in every way that he can. I want us to consider for a moment some of the skirmishes in the war between God and Satan that have taken place. And we know about many of these, of course, from the Scriptures. So we know about the situation with Adam and Eve, and it seemed that Satan had won. I mean, the only two people on earth had broken the only rule that God had given, and they had fallen to sin, and they brought death into the world. And surely, this was Satan's great triumph. He had defeated God, and yet he hadn't. What we find is then he tries again with Cain and Abel, and Cain slays Abel, bringing more death into the world. And this time, the death of the righteous at the hands of the death of the wicked, at the hands of the wicked, bringing that death. And then Satan thinks, well, there we go. I've got him now. But Seth is born, and Adam and Eve find that they have another one to replace Abel, who had died. And then when Seth is old enough that he has a child, that child is born, and it says after Seth's son is born, then men began to call on the name of the Lord. Things turned around. What Satan thought was going to be his victory, Cain killing Abel, became a defeat. We go on down though, and more people become more and more wicked to the point where Noah is the only righteous one left. And Satan thinks again that he's won, because there's no one righteous left. But instead of Noah growing old and dying and being the last righteous one, God instead saves Noah, wipes out the wicked with the flood, and starts again. and Satan loses again. Now understand that all along the way here, of course, Satan is winning souls. Satan wins Cain's soul. Satan wins the souls of many of Cain's descendants and even many of Seth's descendants. Even though Noah remains faithful to God, there are many others who don't. And then after the flood, the continuation of these things, and it continues to escalate to the time of the Tower of Babel. And again, Satan is winning battles here and there, left and right. And then along comes Abraham. And Satan feels a blow as God chooses Abraham and promises Abraham that through his seed, all the nations of the world are going to be blessed. However, Abraham doesn't have any seed. He doesn't have any children. And so Satan is fairly confident in this situation. And then he even convinces Abraham and Sarah to go their own way. And Abraham takes Hagar and has a child through Hagar, which is not what God's plan was. But Satan's always good at trying to get us to substitute his plan or our plan in place of God's plan. But God tells Abraham, this isn't the one. This isn't the way we're going to do this. Your son is going to come through Sarah. And so he does. And there's Isaac. And then from Isaac comes Jacob, and Jacob and Esau fight and fuss. And then through Jacob come those that become the 12 tribes, but Joseph is nearly killed by his brothers, finally sold into slavery. Satan must surely have thought he had done something important there. Jacob's favorite son sold into slavery. But in fact, Joseph later tells his brothers, "What you meant for evil, God meant for good, to save you all this day." As the famine raged on, Joseph, because he was in Egypt and because of the dreams of Pharaoh and because of the planning of years, had food and brought his family to Egypt and saved them all. But then the Jews were enslaved. And it seems Satan is winning again. But God raises Moses up to bring them out of that slavery. But then in the wilderness, they turn away from God multiple times, so much so that Corinthians tells us that those things that are written those things were written for an example to us, so that we would learn not to do the kinds of evil things that they did. Because they time and again rejected God and tried to do everything the wrong way. Moses finally, after 40 years of wandering with them, passes the torch to Joshua, and Joshua brings them into the promised land after all of those that had left Egypt had died except for him and Caleb. And then we find to the book of Judges that everyone is just doing their own thing. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And again, they've lost track. But still, there are those flickers of light. We have, during that dark time of the Judges, we also have the beautiful story of Ruth. Of a woman who was not even a Jew. And yet, she comes to believe in God. And Boaz, who continues to do the things that God had commanded the Jews to do, even though others around him had forgotten. And through them, then comes King David eventually, a couple more generations down the road. David, who had the faith to slay giants. But Satan, of course, doesn't give up. There's one thing we can learn from Satan, it's to never give up. He never gives up. He constantly keeps on the attack. And so he attacks David, first with sexual desire in the case of Bathsheba. And then he attacks him from within his own household with his own children rising up against him in the case of Absalom. With his trusted advisors turning against him and so on. And then there's Solomon. And Solomon starts out well, but he turns away from God in the end. And again, Satan wins some of these battles. But we know that he's not going to win the war. He still wins these occasional battles. And we could trace that on down as the tribes split from the north and the south, Israel and Judah. And Israel does not have even one good king to rule over them. Judah has some that are better than others and two or three that are really righteous, that really desire to do what God wants done. But even they have their troubles. Even men like Hezekiah wind up showing all of the glory of the kingdom to the Babylonians, who are eventually going to come and take it. Even Josiah, who starts out so well, winds up, perhaps because of his own pride, but Pharaoh Necho is on his way to go fight a battle with somebody else, and Josiah decides he's going to go out and jump in the middle of it. A battle that didn't concern him. And Pharaoh warned him, he said, "I don't have a fight with you, go away, leave me alone. The Lord has sent me to fight with them, not you." But Josiah fought the battle anyway, and he died, a young 35, and Jeremiah laments. The weeping prophet weeps over the loss of Josiah because there had not been a king like him that had restored the law and restored the worship of God the way that he did. And of course, that was the end. After Josiah, a few of his relatives reigned for short periods of time before they're taken into Babylonian captivity. But even in Babylonian captivity, we still see those bright spots. We see people like Daniel. Oh, Daniel, who was such a good man that those who wanted to cause him trouble said, "We cannot find anything to use against him. We've got to find something about his worship, his dedication, his devotion to his God, because that's the only way we're going to get him." And so, of course, they tricked the king to make a law that Daniel couldn't pray to God. And, of course, Daniel violated that law because the king had no authority to make a law like that. But these things continue on until finally, hundreds of years on down the road from there, Jesus comes into the world. Satan, working through King Herod, tries to exterminate the young Jesus before he can even get started, killing all of the babies and all of the young boys, 3 and under. And then he tries again and again. He tries to tempt Jesus himself. He tries to send the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the scribes, the Herodians, and everyone else to tempt him, to try to trick him, to try to trap him, and he can't. He finally gives up on trapping him and decides the way to go is just to kill him. And so he does. What would seem to be the final battle, if he can kill God Himself in the flesh, if he can kill the very Son of God, surely that will be his victory. But no. Instead, what he thought was his victory became his final defeat. And the prophecy from back in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 15, where the woman was promised that her seed would fight against the seed of the serpent, and the serpent was warned that his seed was going to fight against the seed of, and that he would bruise his heel, but that the woman's seed would crush the serpent's head. And Jesus crushed Satan's head when he rose from the grave, destroying Satan's final stronghold, diving into Satan's stronghold and bringing the captives out, freeing people from death. And it's, even though Satan is defeated at every turn, and he continues to fight, and he continues, and still today, even though he is done for, there is no way he can win. Have you ever seen a game or a sporting event or a race or something like that where, the time wasn't up, or it wasn't technically, it was still going on, but it was over, and it had been over for a while. And that's where we are now. The war is over, but it's not over yet. Satan has lost, but he's still fighting. And he's still trying to do what he does the best, and that is to win some little individual battles. As we look around and we see, had a house full this morning, and then we're small in number tonight, and sometimes I know that can be frustrating when we think, well, where is everybody? Why aren't they here with us? And we can get frustrated, and we can get discouraged, and we can get to the point, if Satan has his way, that we give up. But we can't let him win. We know he's lost the war, but he's still battling for each one of us. He still wants to take as many down with him as he can. And so he's still fighting, and he's still trying. I don't know who the author of this little poem was, but they say a lot. God didn't put me on this earth to have an easy time. He put me here to fight a fight, to hold a battle line. He put me here to help the weak and myself to grow strong. He put me here to lend a hand and help the world along. He put me here to say a word of encouragement and cheer. He put me here to sing a song for someone else to hear. He didn't put me here to whine, stick out my lip, and pout. He put me here to do his work and save Satan's evil rout. He only asked that I do my best to carry out his plans, forget rewards and starry crowns, and leave all in his hands. God calls us to be faithful until death, to continue to hold the line, to continue to stand for him, to continue to keep our souls with him and not abandon our souls to Satan, as so many over the years have done, who have given in to Satan's tricks and his promises and his deceptions and his lies or his threats, whatever the case may be. So as we conclude tonight, I want us to think about this. And we need to answer this question: who is winning the battle for your soul? Who are you helping? Whose side are you fighting on? It's been said that in this battle for our souls, the devil votes against us, and God votes for us, but we get to cast the deciding vote. Which way will our vote go? Will we vote for us to be with God, to be on His side, to be victorious? Or will we vote with Satan against ourselves to bring ourselves nothing but doom and pain and sorrow? If you're here tonight and perhaps you feel discouraged, perhaps you need some encouragement from the church, perhaps there are other issues in your life that you need to bring before the church, whatever the case may be, if you have a need to respond to God's invitation, please do so as we stand and